Welcome to the Business Exit Roundtable with Heath Franson, along with his guests, real experts with real ideas and actionable strategies for leveraging the wealth in your business. And now, here's the author of The Psychology of Money, founder and CEO of Delta Business Services, your host, Heath Franson.
Welcome to the Business Exit Roundtable. I'm your host, Heath Franson, and our guest today is asking business owners and entrepreneurs in all phases of their lives this important question: are you mentally tough? Mike Gillette is a former Army paratrooper, SWAT officer, bodyguard to Fortune 500 executives, counterterrorism expert, hypnotist, and Guinness World Record holder for his mind-blowing feats of physical strength. Mike has worked as a consultant to some of the world's most recognizable and celebrated businesses, including Air Canada, JetBlue, JW Marriott, and the Walt Disney Company, to name just a few. Mike Gillette has also been a guest on numerous radio and television programs, including CBS TV's Guinness World Records Unleashed. Not too shabby from a guy who grew up scrawny and fearful in a family where mental and emotional abuse held sway. Welcome to the show, Mike.
Thanks, Heath. Great to be with you.
It's a pleasure to have you here. Let's jump right into it. So, now I alluded a little bit to your challenging upbringing. Before we jump into the discussion of toughness, though, I think it would be a great idea if you could fill in some of the blanks for our audience. Tell us a bit about who you are and how you came to see the value of both physical toughness and mental toughness.
Okay, Heath. One of the things that now that I'm no longer working in the government sector, I can be a little bit more transparent with some of the details of my earlier life. When I was a kid, I grew up in a situation that was, to put it politely, challenging. My parents had to get married back in an era when that's what you do when confronted with certain circumstances. It did not last. And when I was 4 years old, my mother and I were fending for ourselves, which would have been challenging enough, but my mother was kind of an angry person. She was adrift emotionally. Her own parents had divorced, and that was in an era when the only people who ever got divorced were movie stars, sometime, back in the early 50s. And as a result, she was carrying a lot of anger and frustration with her, and this caused her to seek out relationships that were not helpful, relationships that were oftentimes temporary. And our lifestyle kind of reflected that transient, chaotic essence, if you will. Eventually, she settled down with a guy who, defining characteristic was that he beat her a lot. Her coping mechanism for that was to drink a lot. His coping mechanism for how angry she was alcohol. Between the two of them, it just kind of spun round and round. And, we didn't have a lot of money. We moved a lot, all of those types of things. So the lack of structure, I think, is sort of an analogous to a lack of toughness, a lack of mental discipline. So I saw what life was like absent those things. And I know how that I felt in sort of a drift and physically weak perspective. And things got worse over time. The violence continued. My mother passed away from a brain tumor when I was 15 years old. And I continued to manifest a lot of the negativity that I had sort of absorbed up to that point. And ultimately, when I was 18 years old, I tried to cash in my chips, which is a more comfortable way of saying that I had had enough and I had just stopped caring. And I tried to check out and consumed a bottle of painkillers, lots and lots of alcohol in a cheap motel room by the interstate because I didn't want anyone in my family to discover me. But here's the thing, Heath, I survived that. And that led to, obviously, some reflection. And that reflection led me to conclude two things. Number one, it must take an awful lot to kill Mike Gillette. And number two, since I was still around, I viewed that in essence as a second chance. Mm-hmm. From that day forward, I slowly started the process of pulling a complete 180. So from that moment on in 1981, I started the slow march towards becoming the person that I am still today and still, you know, continue to try to be a better version of myself tomorrow than I am today. So that's sort of the part of the story that most people are not aware of, because people see the clips on YouTube, the crazy stuff that I do, they're aware of the professional history, and it creates the impression, Heath, of somebody who was probably always like that. Somebody who came from a solid upbringing, saw the value of hard work and discipline and mental toughness, and just absorbed those qualities. In actuality, it was quite the opposite. I had to be confronted with what a lack of those things looks like in order to develop the appreciation that I have for being the kind of person that I try to be. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So here we are. That's the short version of sort of what led me to pursue the direction that I started pursuing a number of years ago and still continue to pursue, and now try to help other people pursue as well.
Well, you bring up a good point, and that is that I think a lot of us have our own visions of what it means to be mentally and physically tough. Can you tell us your definition of toughness and how it plays into the life of a business owner?
Sure. Well, when we talk about mental toughness, what we're really talking about is attitude or mindset. The mindset, it's just a particular way that we think. Your set of opinions or beliefs about a particular thing, oftentimes just your worldview. And when you talk to people, you can get a sense of their worldview just based on how they live their lives. You know, you can see the presence or lack of discipline in a person. So from a nuts and bolts perspective, Heath, people who are mentally tough seem to manifest consistency, stability, and are able to progress, not accidentally, but strategically and deliberately through their lives, whereas people who are not mentally tough really struggle. Now, they may be smart enough or talented enough to occasionally hit their target, but when they do, it's kind of a mystery how they got there, and they can't stay on target for very long. So mental toughness really, for me, is sort of an evolution of ideas. And the ideas are basically every action begins as a thought. Every thought obviously begins in our mind. But my belief is that one can, with practice, consciously and intentionally direct their thoughts. Now, that's not the same thing as being able to control your thoughts, control your moods, but I believe that you can direct them. I think we can sort of own our feelings and own our attitudes and be very cognizant of when non-productive attitudes are entering our minds. And with practice, I think we can deal with those. We can sort of, you know, put those on the shelf. We can park those when necessary so that we can remain productive or we can remain positive. And oftentimes those two things go together, but it's a process, Heath. And processes take time. They take practice. And what we know about practice is the results are proportional to the time that we invest.
All right. And so for a business owner, you're basically retraining, or for anyone for that matter, you're retraining the entire set of neural pathways. You're retraining the brain at its very core, the anchors, so to speak, of the thought life in the brain, in the mind. And you're retraining that. Is that what I'm hearing you say?
If you're hearing me say that, that suggests to me that you've read about this kind of stuff before. You're obviously conversant with the terminology, and that's awesome. Essentially, we retrain ourselves by doing things that are in accordance or sort of aligned with what our goals or objectives are. So, yeah, you're absolutely right. Correct. But in terms of the reason for doing this, it's not just so that we can get more done. It's because doing this actually makes us better. Anyone who cultivates mental toughness is working on a process, and that process is developing the ability to handle any means or category of stress that you can think of, whether it's physical, mental, or emotional. If a person is better at handling those things, are we not just getting more done? We're also becoming better. You know, I'll be a better leader if I can handle the rigors of modern life, if I don't transfer my stress onto my subordinates. And we've all worked for people who don't handle things well. And we've worked for people who seem to be pretty smooth and unflappable, even when things are getting a little crazy. And we know who we prefer to work for. We know who we prefer to spend time around. We know who we'd rather have as a friend. The funny thing about mental toughness is it contains the word tough. And tough is kind of a tricky term for a lot of people. People think of that as, well, if I'm trying to make myself tough, I'm making myself hard or cold or aloof, and it's none of those things. If you're mentally tough, you're a far more pleasant person to hang around. So it's as much a benevolent thing that you can do for the other people in your circle as something that you can do to improve yourself.
And I think when you make yourself a better person, you make the world a better place.
Absolutely. No question about that.
Now, Mike, when you ask people if they are mentally tough, I'm betting that most of them say no, or I don't know, or not really sure, or some answer like that. Why is this the wrong way to think? And how could being untough be detrimental to a business?
Well, I look at it in terms of, okay, if I was going to ask someone, what do you think? Are you mentally tough? And they would probably say some variation of the responses that you just gave. You know, they're either unsure because they're not really sure what the parameters of the definition are, or they just don't think of themselves as tough. So I'll simply reframe the question. I'll say, how effective are you at what you do? And then they'll think about that. I said, okay, you know, are you competent in the workplace? Do you feel like you know what you're doing? And I'll say, oh, okay, yeah. I said, great. How about your interpersonal relationships? How do you do with other people? You know, what are your communication skills like? How organized do you feel? All of these things are simply subcategories of measuring our overall effect. Somebody who's mentally tough is going to be effective. People who aren't effective or don't perceive themselves as effective are not going to be feeling mentally tough. And in fact, they may not be. So it's really figuring out ways for people to grasp what mental toughness is all about, because it's going to show up a little bit differently for different people based on the kinds of things that they currently do or aspire to do. But if we can give them a point of reference for mental toughness that makes sense, and then we can sort of reverse engineer some action steps from that so they have something to work towards.
Couldn't said it been any better myself. That's one of the things we do at Delta is we figure out, okay, let's begin with the end in mind, and what is the result, and let's reverse engineer it, and what are the practical action items that we can take that are objectively measurable, and someone else can come along and measure our progress and whether we hit our objectives or not, and just back it up. And then now we've got a roadmap, so to speak. And you know what it does, Mike, is it streamlines the process. It takes away any of the bunny trails and rabbit paths that someone might go down, and it just keeps you right on task, moving towards your outcome, the desired outcome in business, whether it's business or in life. It could be in working out and getting fit. It could be in business. It could be in investing. It could be in a relationship. It could be in for anything. This is applicable to anything.
Quite agree. It's always so surprising to people when they hear it explained in terms like that, because it's clear, fairly simple. And now it's not necessarily simple to execute, you know, because you have to have people who can execute and stay focused. Mm-hmm. But it's really a question of seeing the objective and sweeping all of the nonsense out of the way and continue to march towards that objective. That's where the discipline comes in. And you know, some people use that term sort of synonymously with mental toughness. You know, I need more discipline. One of the things that interests me when I talk to people is when they say, oh, I'm just not tough. You know, I'm not mentally tough, to which I'll say, you may not be, but that's different than saying I'm not tall. If you're an adult and you say you're not tall and you're not tall, you're not getting any taller. But mental toughness is not mysterious. If you don't have it, you just haven't learned it yet. You haven't accepted the fact that it's real and you can own it. You just have to take some steps so that you can claim it. whether it's a formal coach relationship or even just a good mentor in the workplace, you know, that's mm-hmm. just good at bringing that out in people. We need to get people to accept the fact that, yeah, it's there. You know, it's literally a brass ring. You just need to grab it, and then you simply have to hold on to it. And holding on to it just means that you don't let go.
So, Mike, you've said that there are three essential steps to developing this mental toughness. Can you outline those ideas for us and tell us how business owners can use them right now to develop the mental toughness for themselves and their team and incorporate it into their corporate culture?
Well, if we're talking about business owners or entrepreneurs, we're actually already at step one. And step one is identifying that thing. What is that thing? And to put it in another term, what are you dreaming of? What is it that you aspire to? What is it that you are passionate about? Most people who are entrepreneurial have no problem with that. They can tell you. Some of them can tell you several things, and they have to whittle that down a little bit. So first we have to recognize, you know, what is that thing? Now, once we've identified that and allowed ourselves sort of mentally, emotionally to be okay with having it, because that's another internal struggle that some people do have, is how do we get there? What's the plan? And you just alluded to that a moment ago. You know, and one of the easiest ways to build that plan is to begin with the end state in mind and reverse engineer back. So first thing, you know, what are you passionate about? What is your dream? Dream big. The second thing is make a really good plan. One of the keys to a really good plan is to have contingencies built in. How do we know this is a good plan? What are going to be our interim mileposts? How do we know if we're getting off track? How do we know if this thing is not working at all, and what are we going to do then? Are we going to have an alternate plan? You know, how flexible is this plan? How flexible are we in our approach to getting to the end state? So there's the dream, the big one, hopefully. There's the plan, an excellent one, hopefully. And then there's the work, the secret, the mystery, the execution. I was in a meeting at another job, and at the time it was a large training project for a large company, and my boss at the time was a former commander of Delta Force, called the unit on the TV show, but extremely secretive, high-level military unit, primary focus is counterterrorism. They have the best people, the best equipment, the best budget, the best of everything. And he was in charge of that. So he had a certain level of expectation. And he came into the office. Several of us were talking about how we were going to approach this particular training project. And he listened for a moment. And then he asserted himself into the conversation and said, "Okay, man, we've had just about enough great ideas. What we need now is violent execution." And although that's kind of a simple-sounding anecdote, there's a lot there. Because we can, particularly if we're somewhat clever, you know, sort of get caught up in that Mobius strip of, you know, circular wonderfulness where we just can't get over all of the great ideas we're having. Or sometimes those great ideas are where we kind of hide out because we're afraid to take the next step. But eventually, you've got to execute. The execute is the work. That is the X factor. What is the one thing that separates people with great ideas from people? The work is the least glamorous part. The work is the hardest part. The work can be the scariest part, but it's the work that gets us there. Mental toughness is the one thing that keeps you on that path, that keeps you focused, that keeps you away from those rabbit trails you mentioned. It's what keeps you marching forward, boldly forward.
That's a great story, and I'm familiar with Delta Force all the way up to the founder of Delta Force, Charlie Beckwith, and his team, and all the cross-training that they did very early on with their counterparts in the Navy, which a lot of our listeners are probably familiar with, the SEAL Team 6, with Commander Dick Marcinko over at SEAL Team 6. Those teams have very similar mission profiles, counterterrorism and hostage rescue. That's what they do. And so it wasn't uncommon to have them cross-training. In other words, they would share their wisdom. They would share their experience. And Delta would say, well, this is what's working for us when we take down planes. And Six would say, well, this is what's working for us when we take down trains. And they would improve each other. Iron sharpens iron. Yeah, and I've been keeping tabs on both units all the way up until today.
A good example, even though it may sound a bit far afield from the world's business, excellence is its own language. And as Tony Robbins is well known to say, you know, success leaves clues. So if you have some of the best minds solving tactical problems, why wouldn't you want to avail yourselves, even if you're a Navy person, to what an Army person has to say about a particular means to solve a problem and vice versa? So I think your example is very good just in terms of illustrating why even when you are the best at what you do, you can still learn from others.
That's what makes you the best, is that you keep continuously learn.
Forever a student.
There you go. I think the journey is all about quality of life, is about your journey. And success is all about getting there, not necessarily a particular destination, but it's really more about the process that you go through.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because how many times do we get to there, that place? You know, if I can only get to this spot, then I'll be set, I'll be happy, I'll be whatever. And sometimes we get there and we realize that we're not done yet. Because in the process of getting there, we've seen beyond the next mountain range. And there's some additional mountains off in the distance, and geez, they look pretty interesting. That's how it is for me. Every time I've gotten to an arbitrary milestone, I was always kind of amazed at how I still sort of felt like the same person. You know, that weird transformative thing that I expected to happen, and I don't even know why. No one said it. I just assumed it. I get there, and I'm still me, and I'm still curious, and I'm still hungry, and I just keep pressing on. And I think that when people say, and we hear it all the time, oh, you know, it's life, you know, life's a journey, it's not a destination. Yeah. But I'm really focused on my destination. But then we get to that destination, and that whole journey analogy starts to make a lot more sense.
It really does. Let someone reach the milestone, and they will start seeing the subtle distinction between someone who is an expert at something and someone who decides they want to be a master. An expert will stop learning. An expert will say, you know what? I know this. I know it. I don't need to learn anymore. A master will say, you know what? I've learned a lot about this. I continue to learn, and the process never stops. The process of growth and learning and improving, it just never stops. And I want the mantra of my life to be, you know what, if there's still breath in me, there's still work to do.
I like that. That's good. I'm going to throw something at you, Heath. You were talking about the expertise and mastery. In some of the worlds that I've come from, there's a formal designation for expert, you know, SME, subject matter expert. And I've been recognized a couple of times as, you know, a subject matter expert in a particular topic, or I have appeared in court as an expert witness. But beyond that, in the sort of ephemeral realm, is something called mastery. So I look at it in terms of, if you are really good at other people's material, if you study their material and you can, you know, impart that material, I think you're an expert. If you have studied that same material, but you have your own way of doing things based upon that material, then I think you're a master. Then you've actually added something to the lexicon of whatever realm you're operating in. And the people that I'm most interested in spending time with are in that category. That's what I aspire to be as well, is somebody who, you know, we all need to learn the same. We learn the same alphabet. We learn the same words, but not everybody's a poet. We all know what the notes are on the piano, but not everybody can compose music. So there's, you know, a lot of us have the same common frame of reference, but there are those who just go on and, you know, they've got that wonderful mixture of adventure adventurousness, adventuresomeness. They're adventurous. Okay, we'll go with that. And they're creative as well. You know, when you've got that working for you, regardless of what the specific field of endeavor is, then, you know, you really can hit the world in a big way, cause an impact, ripple effect, all of that.
So I want to get into some other stuff here. Tell me a little bit about your military career, your time with SWAT team, some of the other stuff you've done along those lines.
Well, the interesting thing is that my military time was actually very brief. And my police time, if you look at it in and of itself, was altogether unremarkable. What made either of those experiences remarkable for me is basically I was least likely to when I came into those worlds. You know, I came into the military a very short time after being a very negative person, almost to the point that I was not any person. So the military was really a means to an end at the time. I had decided that what I wanted to do was help people. In my worldview, granted I was very young at the time, I thought that was something I could accomplish as a law enforcement officer. So I actually, at age 19 at that point, was applying at a couple of law enforcement agencies. Now, legally, I was old enough to apply, but no one was hiring kids, in essence, to become cops. And I made it to the interview process of one agency, and they were very nice to me. You know, they, you know, because I did well enough in the testing, they more or less, you know, had to interview me. So we go through that process, and at the end, they said, "Look, you seem like a nice kid, but you need to revisit this, revisit us when you've got, you know, some life experience, you know, maybe some college, maybe some military time, something like that, and you'll probably be a great candidate, but not yet." I said, okay, fine. So college was out of the question. I didn't have money for that. But I knew someone who had college money. His name was Uncle Sam. So I went to the Army recruiter, and things just kind of went from there. Now, I went in for the least amount of time because I wasn't looking at making this a career or anything like that. And but I had qualified via test scores for certain educational bonuses, and those were amped up a bit if you went into what they call a combat arms MOS, which is infantry, which was fine with me because I thought all the jobs in the Army were that. I didn't know that you could be a mechanic or play the tube or, you know, whatever else. So off I go. I'm as happy as I can be. And everything just sort of clicks. As I'm in the Army, I mean, I'm floating along. It's people are noticing me, supervisors. I end up in the 82nd Airborne Division, which I'm very happy about because I think that's amazing at the time because I'm young and excited. And even though I should be spending all of my time in the woods, I had supervisors that were allowing me to take college classes, which was ridiculous. I could barely believe it was happening, but I recognized that it was a good opportunity. So while in the military, I was accruing college credits, and this was helpful. I was married at this time. I was starting to think about what I'm going to do because I'm coming close to the end of my enlistment. And at this point, I'm all Army. I'd kind of forgotten about law enforcement because this Army thing really worked for me. Okay. I was confronted with two possibilities. I was going to reenlist for Special Forces just down the street from where I was stationed at the time. That was a six-year reenlistment, or I was going to get out and participate in an ROTC scholarship that I had become eligible for. My wife and now our brand new baby led me to think that the officer and a gentleman route was probably the more responsible, if less exciting, route. So that's what we did. Exited active duty in 1984, started at the University of Arizona that fall as a sophomore because of the credits I had been able to accrue.
Sure.
And life was all right. It wasn't great. It was all right because I was off active duty. I was in a academic setting in a college town, and I was feeling quite a bit out of my element. Even the military folks at the ROTC department were not exactly what I was used to at Fort Bragg. And I was just young, and I didn't have the adequate, you know, perspective on sort of assimilating to wherever I was, and I was a bit frustrated. But I soldiered on because that's what one does. The day before finals week, I accepted an invitation to go out on a climbing outing in Vail Canyon, east of Tucson, Arizona. a day that started pleasantly and ended horribly, because our plan was to rappel off an abandoned railroad bridge into a canyon, climb back out. I would go home and continue studying for finals. That didn't happen because the person who hooked me up to the rope hooked me up incorrectly. I jumped off the top rail of a railroad bridge and screamed towards the earth as fast as one might imagine, because the only thing slowing me down were my hands. Fortunately, I had leather gloves on. The rope burned through that, burned through my trousers, burned through my shirt. I collided with the earth sufficiently to break my ankles and break my back. And I was stretchered out of the canyon. That same night, I met my orthopedic surgeon-to-be, a former Army orthopedic surgeon. And I said, what's going to happen to me? Because he'd already looked at the x-rays. He said, the good news is you'll walk again. Now, you're not going to run anymore. You're not jumping out of any more airplanes. With that began a very dark 4.5-year period of my life where I was a full-time college student, medically processed, out of the military, was forever removed from any future consideration from the military. Obviously, law enforcement was out. I was not a physical person anymore. And I had built myself into a ferocious physical person while I was on active duty. So in terms of mental toughness, when I go through some of the specifics of how those next 4+ years spooled out, a lot of people say, gosh, Mike, you are so disciplined. You have so much mental toughness. How did you keep focused on your goal? As much as I would like to take credit for being that person, I'm not 100% sure if that's a completely accurate picture. Because it's partially accurate, but I also think that in my case, I'm self-aware enough to recognize what crazy is, what obsessed is, and what an absolute refusal to let something go, even when it physically makes no sense whatsoever. I think there's a line, Heath, and I think the line is somewhere between being very disciplined and being very irrational, because I had an irrational of I could somehow make myself back into this person, even though I was continuing to have connectivity with the medical community and physical therapy and everything else. And I was a complete mess. I mean, I was hobbling around the campus with a back brace on up to the top of my shoulders on those little arm wrap around gimpy crutches. It was bad. Mm-hmm. The pain that I had for years after that, I still feel to this day at age 53. I mean, I carry reminders of that day, December 16, 1984, with me. But fresh from that day, it was a lot worse. So it was a process that I had to go through. I didn't like it. I somehow got through it, to the point where physically I could start looking at least law enforcement again. I pursued that with great fervor, to the point that I in the academy set some fitness records, which got me assigned to very early on a law enforcement fitness trainer course. I think no one else wanted to go is what it was, but that was so that I could return to my agency and serve as sort of an in-house expert. And what I found through that experience, Heath, is that I really liked training. I liked studying. I liked helping, coaching others. And I also liked the pressure that being an instructor in a particular area put on me, because I figured if I'm an instructor of a particular topic, I'm going to have to be the best. And I ended up in the 9 years at that first agency and 3 years subsequent, I have 12 years in law enforcement overall. I amassed nearly 30 certifications in a variety of use of force topics, everything from how to talk to people, how to touch people, all of the intermediate weapons, the various weapon systems, tactics, you name it. And as I acquired these certifications, I found myself traveling further and further away from my day job. Training was obviously the thing that was most interesting to me, most compelling to me. I mean, I was good at my day job, but at the same time, a lot of people at my day job didn't click with me, which is a euphemism. I didn't click with them. I mean, young Mike Gillette had a hard time getting along with people because he was really excited. And I was very passionate about the job. And if you weren't pursuing it with the same fervor that I was probably inclined to think that you were lazy. I was probably inclined to think you were slack. The younger me did not have the people skills that would have made someone like that easy to deal with. Between, you know, sort of my own personality and the fact that I was really passionate about training, I ultimately was looking for opportunities to do more of the training. In 2001, I left law enforcement completely and was involved full-on training from that point onward, which in a matter of months, 9/11 happens. 9/11 had a huge impact on where I went professionally, which is a weird thing. I'm not comfortable with that, but that's just the reality. And it's what led to a lot of work with the airline industry. I did more work post 9/11 with the airline industry than anyone else in the United States. It led to other assignments. You mentioned the Disney company. That was a huge, huge training project because Disney was one of the originally considered 9/11 targets. They had to discard that idea simply because it was logistically too complex. But they wanted to crash a plane into Cinderella's castle. And imagine how the world would have reacted to that visual. See that?
Right.
So I worked extensively with the Disney company. I did some DHS training projects. Ultimately, 2006, ended up in the bodyguard trade. I've been doing some work for a training consulting company in Las Vegas, which is where I was living at the time. And suddenly, they had clients. So for the next 5 years, that's really what I was all about, primarily in a project management sense, which means that I was in charge of a client's team in addition to working with the client and working with some long-term clients, lots of travel, living in a bubble, unpredictable schedules, all of that. It was interesting for a while, but eventually I realized that I was getting older and there were other worlds I wanted to conquer, and I really just wanted to work with people. Regular people. I had been working with tactical people, if you will, for a number of years, and I really felt that I had maxed out. I was working with the most elite personnel. I had the most elite clients on my protection resume, and there was no place to go with that. The lifestyle was causing me to drain away. 2012. We get to the most recent chapter of Mike Gillette, which is sort of where we are now. I work with regular people. I work with athletes. I work with them physically. I work with them mentally, sometimes both. I've been able to write more, produce products to help people, that I can't physically get to. So we just launched a DVD package on mental toughness 5 weeks ago, which is so far sold in over 40 countries around the world, which is hard for me to wrap my head around, but it's kind of exciting at the same time. Yeah. Yeah. So I have two real books that I've had several ebooks out in the past. I've got some hard physical books, whatever the term is now. I know they're not supposed to be called real books, but in any event, real books, Heath. One on strength training, published by Dragon Door, and one called Mind Boss, which is all mind training, coming out from Outskirts Press, and that's probably a little closer to September. So it's exciting because it's in just 3 years I've been able to get to a point where I'm making, I think, as big an impact in the personal development realm that I used to make in the tactical training arena. Because that's where I wanted to push, I'm very happy to be occupying this particular bandwidth. I like dealing with people again. I was living sort of an isolated life those last few years with the clients and so forth. So this is really great, just engaging with people. I think I'm learning more, too, because there's a lot more back and forth. It's a much more interactive universe that I'm living in now, if that makes sense.
I see where you're coming from. You sort of found your element, or you created your element, and you're continuing to develop that.
Well, a lot of what I did when I was working with, military personnel, law enforcement personnel, I kept thinking to myself at the time, this is really good information. The kinds of lesson plans that I was developing and so forth, I kept thinking regular people, and again, that's an unfortunate designation, but that's what it's coming to me at the moment. Regular people would really benefit from a lot of the same type of information. So when I'm talking to people about cultivating mental toughness, things of that nature, some of it actually comes from that world. Now, some of it comes from my martial arts background. Some of it comes from, you know, the psychology that I've researched in a variety of contexts over the years. And it's all kind of swirls together in a brew that is uniquely me and a culmination of my experiences. But there's a lot there that people benefit from knowing. I mean, all the way down to kids, because I get to spend time with kids. I actually work with some young athletes on an ongoing basis. I work with a group of gymnasts, not even boys, but girls, which was interesting when it first started because we really didn't know how to relate to each other so much. But it's a very high-level program, national champions, lots of D1 scholarships coming out of it, and so forth. Mm-hmm. I am just as passionate about their mental toughness and their physical strength as any SWAT team I've ever worked with. And they reciprocate by working incredibly hard and taking things very, very seriously. And so for me, it's not really so much about, you know, who the end user is, as long as we have one thing in common, which is a lot of passion and no fear of hard work. So it, in essence, it doesn't matter if it's cute teenage girls in leotards and chalk all over their faces, or business people, or action guys. We tailor our message as necessary so that, you know, we can effectively meet people where we are. But if we want to change the world, if we want to make an impact, you know, let's do that. Let's do that across as many spectrums as possible. At least that's what's most interesting to me, and that's what I'm trying to do now.
Thank you so much for doing it, Mike. And you're reaching out to kids, you're getting them early. These lessons are so incredibly valuable. If you think about it in your own life, I know if I think about it in my own life, if I knew then what I know now about mental
right.
toughness, it'd be a completely different world, because I would have had the benefit of that early on, and all of these years, it would have compounded. It would have built up even exponentially beyond that. And I think anyone listening to this would have to agree, you know, these lessons, these gems that we can pass on to kids and get them early so that they can start applying this stuff early on in their life. They're going to be miles ahead of the game, way ahead.
Absolutely.
Of the competition.
They'll work less hard and get more out of it than
Amen.
Those of us
Amen.
Who are working really hard now.
All right. So I want to get into some of these world records here. Tell us something about stuff. I've seen you bending steel. I've seen you, you know, stopping bowling ball. You got to tell me about the bowling ball thing. Tell us about all this stuff. This is great stuff here.
Well, I appreciate that, Heath. In 2008, I was 46 years old, and I had really, when I sort of was confronting the fact that I had kind of topped out in terms of job satisfaction with the whole bodyguard world. But there I was, 46, so, you know, I'm already becoming a bit mature in that line of work. And I'm not a big guy. I'm a smaller guy. I've always been fascinated with training, mental training, physical training, and I've always sought out the best of the best people I could find. I have, at various times in the past, you know, 20, 25 years, I've actually trained one-on-one with some very well-regarded martial artists. There are people who can do things that I'm fascinated by. I'll call them. I'll say, do you do any private training? I'll be right over, and I'll show up at their doorstep, and they'll do what they do, and it's been very enriching. Not everybody is that obsessed. Now, in the case of physical training, I had been aware of a guy for a couple of years. His name is Dennis Rogers. He's actually from Texas. He's down in Houston. He had been referred to for years as pound for pound the world's strongest man. Now, he's a smaller guy, and he's older than me. He's a little bit smaller than I am, but he can do things that are just really inexplicable. He was the first human, for example, to bend a crescent wrench in half in his hands. And just think on that for a moment. And he's not a big guy. What had always fascinated by me, because, you know, I'd seen him on TV shows and on YouTube, and I guess what was most interesting to me was not the stuff that he did, which just that was from another planet in my mind, but how could you train? How could you do those things and not have your body break down? That's what I wanted to know. So I actually reached out to him in 08 and asked him the same question I'd asked other people. Do you do private training? He said, yes, I do, but I'm traveling a lot. It's kind of hit or miss. But if what you want to do is just talk training, to see training in action, then hang on for a couple of months because I've got a workshop coming up. I've got proteges of mine coming in from literally all over the world. You'd be able to talk to all of them, you know, see what all of them do as far as training. And you'd probably get more of what it seems that you're interested in. I said, fantastic, let's do that. So 4 days in August of 2008, I'm in Houston, Texas. I'm around Dennis and all of these other guys who can do just ridiculous things. Now, some of them are just enormous guys, as you might imagine, but at least as many are like Dennis. You would have no idea that they can do what they can
right.
do, which, of course, fascinated me. Now, what I got out of that experience was not any training secrets, per se, because I found that each one of these guys kind of had their own way of doing things. I would describe it as a process, but I'm not even sure that they have a process. They're just very special people. But Dennis, as probably the world's best-known guy in that realm, when he gave me some things to try, just to kind of try, and I sort of had some semi-success to bending a couple of things. I mean, now, I had trained really hard for a number of years, but so have a lot of people. I mean, there are guys that are three times Dennis' size that can never dream of doing what he can do.
Mm-hmm.
And I would never have thought to put myself in the category of any of those guys. But I kind of got some things moving, bending a little bit. And it was just enough to suggest that perhaps it's possible. But Dennis, when all this was said and done, he said, I think you can do this. This is something that's interesting to you. And I said, you know, what's interesting to me, Dennis, is not that I want to show off. What's interesting to me is this platform that you all seem to have. Because when you can go into a place and do something that's impossible, to do something that's actually scary, you have people's attention. And then if you have something to say, you can say it. That's what was attractive to me, Heath. I wanted that.
Right.
And, you know, yeah. I had had enough of living in a very, you know, tiny, fast-moving bubble. I wanted to re-engage with people. And to re-engage with people, you know, as a middle-aged guy, not cool, I needed something. And I instinctively thought that if I can get to where they are, then there might be something there. And I didn't even know what it was. I wasn't even really sure what I wanted to share with the world at that time because I was out of practice at talking to the world at that point. Nonetheless, I pursued it with reckless abandon, hurt myself a lot All right. in the process. You know, 6-8 months go by, I had my first opportunity to present publicly. It was at a church in Florida, and I did a couple of things. It was amazing. It just fueled my interest. I continued to build a repertoire. For whatever reason, without any strategic plan or a lot of effort, the opportunities just, you know, kept coming in. So I continued to build the repertoire. Now, you're talking about specific feats of strength. What I found, Heath, is I'm not really interested in doing what most of those guys do. I don't rip phone books. Everybody's seen that. They're made out of paper. People who do it legitimately, because there's a lot of ways to fake it, the people who do it legitimately, I don't think get appreciated for how hard it is. I don't rip cards. It's paper. It's been done. I have a lot of friends who do, and they're amazing. I mean, they'll, like, pull a notch out of the center of the deck. That is so hard, and the average person has no sense of how hard it is. Whereas a lot of the stuff that I find interesting, you don't really have to understand the physics involved to know that it's, you know, either very dangerous or very painful. And I kind of gravitate towards those things. I break things. I have things broken on me. I do mm-hmm. enough strength-specific stuff just to kind of call myself a strong man. You know, I'll roll the pan and bend the steel bars and bend the horseshoe, and that's fun, but that's about as far as I go with that kind of stuff. But I do other things. You know, I'll have the 8-foot 2x2 post broken over me. I'll put my hand in an animal trap. I'll do the bowling ball, and I'll have to mention the bowling ball because that's what got me into Ripley. I injured myself in 2011. My right bicep pulled off the bone. It was a training accident. Had nothing
Ouch.
To do with feats of strength. I was teaching somebody a technique, you know, basically a jiu-jitsu technique. And what I didn't know at the time is my pain tolerance or my ability to sense pain is completely miswired now. I've been training myself to withstand pain to the point where I don't know when I'm in trouble necessarily. And this was one of those moments. I kept telling the guy, no, tighter, tighter. He was, you know, had me in an arm bar. He's got two arms on my one arm, and I didn't think he had it on that hard. And I said, no, no, go ahead and cinch it up tight. He kept saying, I am. I said, no, no, a little more, a little more. So we keep having that discussion, and then suddenly there's two audible pops, and my arm wiggles in a very uncharacteristic way. He screams because he doesn't know what just happened. Immediately lets go of the arm. I look down, and the bicep's already rolling up like a window shade towards my shoulder. I immediately successfully diagnose that we have a torn bicep. So whilst I was dealing with that and, you know, hoping that I would, with surgery, be able to come back from that, because I was 49 at the time, I had an idea for a possible Ripley stunt. I had been already spent several unsuccessful years trying to connect with Ripley's and do something super cool. So I came up with an idea. Now, it's something that I had done. I had done what's called the bowling ball drop. And the bowling ball drop is, you know, very dangerous. It's excruciating because you're taking this sphere, which is very hard, and only about 4.5 actual inches of the surface of the ball, basically a fist, makes contact with the abdomen. It's usually dropped off, you know, from a height. And obviously the greater the height, the more the impact. So I had an engineer friend compute what it would take height-wise to create 6,000 pounds or 3 tons of impact pressure per square inch. So he came up with that. And I thought, to amp it up a little bit, I would do that stunt while laying on a pile of broken glass. I submit that to Ripley's. Ripley says, sounds very interesting. Let us know how it goes. So we video, photograph, you know, I send all of the computations. They do one of those little cartoons of Mike Gillette. Mm. And let me tell you, 10-year-old Mike Gillette was really excited by that, because when I was a kid, I used to read those books in the school library just obsessively. But I also ended up in this year's Ripley's Believe It or Not book. They sent me a really nice certificate. They were super cool. So that's how I got into Ripley's. Was the bowling ball drop. It was 8.8 feet, and it, at that height, based on the, you know, dimensions, weight of the ball, and so forth, it created that magical 3-ton, because that's what I was going for, a nice round number that people would understand. Pounds of pressure per square inch impact force on the abdomen while laying in a pile of broken glass. So that was my first really reckless stunt. And I haven't recreated that particular one since then. And frankly, don't feel I need to. You know, I've done broken glass, I've done bowling balls, but not quite from that height. Meanwhile, the Guinness thing, I had contacted Guinness 3 or 4 times with different ideas. And every time the response was the same. This is too dangerous. We can't sign off on this. You know, have a nice day. Now, I thought I was basically done with Guinness until spring of 2013, when I got a call from a casting producer from a television show called Guinness World Records Unleashed. It was going to be their second season. A friend of mine had been on Gino Martino, been on their first season. He hammers nails with his forehead, like into wood.
Right.
He was also on Stanley Superhuman. He's awesome and, you know, kind of crazy. So he recommended me. They called me, and we started to discuss some things. And they said, well, what can you do that would work in the context of the TV show? So we kicked some things around. And what we ultimately came up with is, they said, you know, we like that thing you do with the arrows. You know, you take the steel-tipped arrow. And you put the tip in your throat, and you push against it, and it breaks. They said, let's see how many of those you can do in 60 seconds. And I said, sure. We actually had to sort of field test it, because to create a record, they had to have some kind of baseline. Uh-huh. This had not been attempted before. This is kind of like a behind-the-scenes info, Heath. So it's just between you and me, right? No one else is going to hear this. Anyway, I had a show at Coney Island in May of 2013, and we did it then. The idea was, let's basically do the same thing, and we'll see how many arrows, assuming that, you know, I don't perforate myself, would reasonably be able to be done in 60 seconds time. It's the last thing I'm going to do. The clock starts, and, you know, off I go. And this is right after I'd already bent a length of rebar against my throat, so I was a bit, you know, pre-tenderized, if you will. So 60 seconds is over, and I got 11. I sent an email the following week to my segment producer at Guinness, and he said, okay, we'll tell Guinness. Guinness comes back and says, if this is going to be a world record, you're going to need to break at least 12. Okay, then. So we'll see how that goes. And truthfully, I had barely gotten 11. So I wasn't feeling super solid about this because we hadn't really figured out the mechanics, how all this is going to be, you know, how the air is going to be brazed and how you can do it in a way that's, you know, non-subjective, because usually I just have a person hold a board. So they created kind of an elaborate mechanism, you know, freestanding wall for me to press against, and then we taped the show. And I am snapping arrows like anybody's business. But one of the things that I wasn't expecting, Heath, is they told me right before I started, oh, it doesn't count unless the arrow is broken completely in two. Now, I had messed around with a couple of the arrows that they bought. They wouldn't trust me with my own arrows because, you know, what if they were like balsa wood, or what if they were trick arrows, right, or who knows what, which I completely understand. So they ordered the arrows. They ordered the wrong arrows. I said, order cedar wood, because cedar wood will break. If it's birch or something like that, it's going to splinter. I mean, it'll be broken, but it'll just be like a willow twig. You know, it's still kind of connected. Well, they got some wood that was not cedar. So I noticed the day before, I broke one or two just on a trial basis, and neither one of them broke cleanly. I didn't think anything of it because I didn't know that was going to be criteria for the record. It wasn't until we were taping the segment, studio audience, you know, we're in this aircraft hangar in Santa Monica where, you know, they built this really cool set and there's lights and whatnot. And they said, oh, by the way, if it's not broken completely into two segments, that arrow does not count. So I'm breaking arrows. The clock is running, you know, the crowd's yelling. And I can see every now and again that one of these arrows will fly through the air and it's still connected. So I had no idea at the time how I was doing. There was no way for me to mentally keep count with everything else that was going on.
Right. Sure.
So if you're to watch that segment, which you can find at Mike Gillette, you know, my YouTube channel, which is, there's an icon there at MikeGillette.com, they kind of faked me out a little bit, but I just somehow got 12 arrows. There were 18 total that broke, but only 12 that were broken completely too.
Wow.
So
you
were
did
sufficient
it.
For the world record. And subsequent to that, I have another record, not through Guinness, but through recordsetters.com, which is kind of an upstart company based in Vegas that are they're hot on Guinness's heels. I broke several arrows all at the same time because it dawned on me that no one had ever done that. And, you know, I had people research it, and it appears as though no one has ever broken two arrows at the same time. So for the record, I broke three. So I broke three arrows against my throat simultaneously. I am the only person with the total disregard for sensibleness to have done so. So that's two records in a Ripley's entry, all of which happened beyond the age of 50 years old.
Mike Gillette, you are amazing. You are absolutely amazing. This is, and you're half crazy, too. So this has been a great interview.
You're probably being kind.
We got to have you back, buddy. This has been a great talk. Thank you so much for being on Business.
Well, I appreciate that. It was awesome to talk to you. Kindred spirits.
Oh, you bet. Mike Gillette, you're too bad that we only have an hour. Because the whole thing is certainly worth taking the time to dig deeper, whether it's from a psychology perspective or learning more about mental toughness and how to do it. It is a cultivated skill. Talking more about your crazy feats of strength, your world records, and, you know, all of the great stuff that you do. It's just been a blast. Thank you so much. Listeners, Mike has made it easier for you to learn more, and business owners, executives, entrepreneurs, they can put the power of mental toughness to work for them with his new online course. We've got to plug it. It's called Strength Psychology. And listeners, you can find out all about it by going to www.tinyurl.com/toughmind. That is www.tinyurl.com/toughmind. Once again, Mike Gillette, you're awesome, buddy. Thank you so much for being on Business
Thanks
Exit
so much,
Roundtable. And so that's going to do it for this edition of the Business Exit Roundtable. I want to thank Mike Gillette, of course. I want to thank my assistant, Tammy DeLue, for putting everything together, my entire team at Delta Business Services, and the Delta Business Radio Network. And if you are an exiting business owner and you want to find out more about how you can sell your business, get cash flow for life, and pay zero taxes, we would be interested in having a conversation with you. Go to www.deltabusinessservices.com or you can call the office always at 210-369-4161. Thank you again, everyone. God bless you, and cheers to your exit success.
Thanks for listening to the Business Exit Roundtable with Heath Franson, featuring real experts with real ideas about planning for a spectacular life that's more exciting and prosperous. Set your calendar and make the appointment to join us again next week when we'll solve more common problems faced by business owners who want to exit on the Business Exit Roundtable.